This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Beginning in the 1930s, the U.S. government commissioned photographers to make a record of the impact of the Depression. We're most familiar with the images that speak to the hardships of the time. Dorothea Lange's photograph, Migrant Mother, comes immediately to mind. But other photographs speak to the religious spirit and strength of the nation. On the program today, we'll talk about the latter with Colleen McDaniel, author of Picturing Faith, Photography, and the Great Depression. The book gives readers a sense of the practice of religion in the 1930s and 40s. Religion was an important part of the lives of Americans. Colleen McDaniel offers us a sampling of photos made across the country by photographers including Lange, Walker Evans, Russell Lee, and Gordon Parks. The photos were made across the country. They include images of Protestants who had fled the Dust Bowl to work in the fields of California, Catholics along the U.S.-Mexican border, rural Jews farming in the East, and African Americans at worship in Chicago. Listeners, you may join our discussion with a telephone call this afternoon. I look forward to hearing from you. Your questions and comments are invited. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Colleen McDaniel is a professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah. In addition to Picturing Faith, she is the author of Material Christianity and Heaven: A History. All three books are published by the Yale University Press. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor McDaniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing quite well. And yourself?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, what I want to know is what led you to these photographs? That's my first question.
Well, I had just finished my book, Material Christianity, and I had used some of the photographs as illustrations because I was trying to find examples of real people being religious, real people's religious practices. And it's always hard to find the average person. You can find all sorts of wonderful theological treaties and the ideas of seminary professors, but how do you find what real people do? So I had gone to Washington, and I was looking through the file of photographs to find the interiors of people's homes to see what kinds of religious objects that they had and what they were doing with them. And then after I wrote that book, I thought, you know, I really love these photographs. These are gorgeous photographs. They're classics. And I wanted to explore more about the people who actually took the photographs and why they took them.
Yeah. Now, you just said that the photographs are beautiful. They are. They are quite powerful as well. You could see them as art. You could see them as journalism. You could see them as propaganda. How do you view them overall?
I think that you can't split those things up. I think that they are all beautifully coordinated, and at times the photographers were, they had specific ideas in mind. They were told by their boss, go out and get pictures of people going to church and coming from church. And at other times, there was something about the form or the structure of a church or the interior of a poor people's house that just caught their eye, and they took pictures. So, you know, they were not always conscious, I think, of what they were doing. They worked on a variety of different levels, and that's what makes the photograph so engaging.
Mm. Their boss was Roy Stryker. Tell us about him.
Roy Stryker had started off on a ranch in Colorado, and he was the youngest son of a rather large family. And he was someone who just didn't want to stay on the farm. He wanted to do something different in his life. So he ended up becoming an engineer, going to school in Colorado. And then when he was going to school doing his science and engineering studies, he met a minister who sort of turned him on to the possibilities of changing society, of improving things. And so instead of following the path of science, he decided that he would try to understand the economic and social order of the United States. And this minister connected him with a school in New York City, and he went with his wife to New York, and then he decided he didn't like religion. He decided that religion had some serious problems and that there was a sense that it was kind of going nowhere, and all the exciting things were happening at Columbia. And so he then went and went to school in Columbia and got connected with one of his professors, who eventually became the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture. And both of these two men were interested in how photography and visual culture could persuade people or could illustrate problems, social problems in the United States. And it was from there that during the Depression, when the New Deal came out to try to improve the economic and social conditions of Americans, that they thought, you know, photographs, that's the way to do it. That's the way to convince people of the problem and show some possible solutions.
Yeah. And this is an era of social activism, isn't it, overall? Couldn't you say that? Would that be fair?
Yes, social activism and also people thinking that they could make a difference. And, you know, remember, this is a period when the federal government is growing and when people are thinking that, you know, the government can help us out. The government can provide good things for us. You know, now we're a bit on the jaded side. We're very skeptical about the influence of big organizations. But the Depression was a period when people were thinking that the traditional ways that poverty, for instance, was coped with in the United States, churches, synagogues, city organizations, just couldn't do it, just couldn't seem to change the direction of the country. And so people were thinking in the 30s and early 40s that it was the federal government that really had the power to change people. And there was a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of hope and a lot of excitement about the possibilities of changing the state of people's lives in the United States.
And one way to get that change, to get the ball rolling, these photographs of people living their lives across the country. So tell us now a little bit about the photographic project of the Farm Security Administration and how it actually came about.
Well, again, Roy Stryker and his boss, Tugwell, they thought that if Americans could just see the problems, that it would help them understand and support the New Deal. Because you have to keep in mind, Americans just, you know, in some ways like they are now, are very reluctant to pay for things that they don't think that they're going to get their money back on. And so they want some proof. They want to know that things are happening. And keep in mind that this is a period of time before television, before news magazines, before the whole picture reporting that we got after the Second World War. And so Americans really didn't know much about the country in general. You know, they were getting the beginnings of movies, so they had some images in movie theaters, but they didn't travel as much as we do now. They just didn't know as much that, you know, what was going on. And so Stryker's idea was to take photographs and then to bring the photographs to the people. So they had the photographs made up exhibitions. They made posters that they traveled around and sent to clubs and churches, and anybody could get these photographs. You could just write a letter to Stryker and say, I'd like to have an exhibition about sharecropping, and he would put together a series of photographs and send them to you, and almost like a lending library. And so these photographs appeared in newspapers, in magazines, in big associations, campuses, mounted them, and that really got the word out to the American people in a very intimate and realistic way about what was happening in the country.
And how successful then were these photographs in helping the Roosevelt administration New Deal?
I think they were actually very successful. Of course, they were a part of many different organizations. They call them the alphabet organizations, where people are going out and planting trees, or they're learning how to do art. The government is doing all sorts of things, theater projects, and it's bringing a whole variety of different activities to the American people. And the photographs were part of a concerted effort to both perk up the economy by providing people with money for doing things, but also to get them involved in a kind of the common good that the government was trying to promote.
Hmm. How many photographs were made during this period of time, the 6-year period?
It's a little bit difficult to say because some of the photographs were actually the ones that didn't turn out very well were destroyed, but scholars estimate that as many as 200,000 were produced, and now you can log on to the Library of Congress site and see about 164,000 that are now online.
Well, how many deal with religion? Can we know at this point?
You know, it's very difficult to tell, and it's also difficult even to define, you know, what is religious. So, for instance, if you have a picture of somebody's house, the interior of a house, and the photographers took the picture because it showed sub-marginal housing, you know, plaster falling off and wooden, rickety wooden floors, and people looking, you know, very they're not comfortable. It's wind is just maybe blowing through these things. But then there are beautiful prints, religious prints on the wall. Is that a religious photograph or is it a photograph of submarginal housing? I was working with about 500 photographs. And now that they are online, you can actually do searches and you can look for all of the photographs that have the word church in them or the word priest or something like that, and you can pull those up. But I was actually working primarily with about 500 photographs.
Mm. Can you give us an overall sense in terms of what you've seen in those photographs that you've worked with, what they say in general about the practice of religion in the United States during the Great Depression?
One of the things that the photographers were interested in doing, and that also fit into the mindset of intellectuals in the 1930s, they were trying to photograph everyday religious life, just the life of normal religious people. So they didn't take pictures of famous preachers. They didn't take pictures of organizations. They weren't taking pictures of beautiful churches in the centers of cities. And they wanted to know what everyday religious life was like. And so there are beautiful photographs of small rural churches in the South. There are wonderful photographs of religious shrines in people's homes. There are photographs of local ministers or local priests that are perhaps in a cemetery saying prayers for All Saints and All Souls Day. So these are the kinds of very everyday, common types of activities that people would recognize. But for those of us who are scholars, those oftentimes are the hardest things to find. So the photographs provide us a beautiful glimpse into a certain kind of life. And these were also pictures that were not extraordinary. So they weren't taking pictures of people in revival meetings when they were all excited and having a very emotional religious feelings. These were like average everyday activities, church going and the interiors of churches and women who were involved in doing monthly cleanings of the churchyards and these kinds of activities.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the decisions the photographers made in terms of what to include in a photograph and what to leave out?
Well, some of the photographs are deliberate pictures of religious activities, and some are basically accidental. It goes back to the thing I was mentioning earlier. I document in Picturing Faith how the photographers, as they moved closer and closer to the Second World War, became more interested in making photo essays. And so sometimes they would go into communities with a particular idea in mind. So they were trying to find pictures that would give people a clue about what was happening in a particular town or in a particular area. And so then they would take pictures of religious communities and tell a little story about the communities.
Yeah, so this photo essay phenomenon, then does that give us a shift in how American life is portrayed?
Yes, one of the things I argue in Picturing Faith is that in the early part of the project, in the 30s, the photographers were not particularly interested in religion because religion oftentimes showed an enduring local spirit, an enduring pride, an enduring creativity. And they were basically trying to show that the Depression was ruining communities, that it was destroying the landscape, and that it was fundamentally a disruptive project. But what they ended up taking pictures of were rural churches where people had spent a lot of time and a lot of energy, even though they might not have very much money, to create these very beautiful examples of local architecture. And so that oftentimes worked against their idea that they were trying to show Americans as dispossessed and as very poor. But then as we move closer towards World War II, they want to show America as being creative, as being confident and strong and innovative. And so especially in rural America, the place where many Americans were the most creative was in their, you know, in their churches and in the building shrines, decorating cemeteries, these kinds of places. And so all of a sudden, religion becomes something that you want to show because it shows people's strength and their ability to take, not have very many resources, but then to come up with something that's quite beautiful and spiritual. And so then they became more interested in showing photographs of religious activities.
What kind of instruction did Roy Stryker give his photographers in terms of what to photograph, and did he say how he wanted things done?
He oftentimes would send them scripts which would describe what it was he was looking for in the file. So, for instance, at one point, he was asked to put together an exhibition of small-town America. And so he would write some of his photographers who were out in the field, and he would say, please go and take pictures of churches where people are going into the churches and going out of the churches because I'm trying to, you know, build this. We need these in the file. And he would then write them, and he would send them materials to help them understand what they were seeing. So he might send them books about economics or about rural poverty or about New England or the South or tobacco growing, whatever it was that he thought would help them, you know, understand what they were taking pictures of. So he oftentimes would direct them, and he certainly would send them usually to certain parts of the country. But sometimes there were freelance photographers who were just traveling on their own, and they oftentimes would send Stryker photographs as well, and those images also found their way into the file.
Yeah. Now, religion led, I think we could say this, religion led Roy Stryker to social activism, but then, as you said earlier, then he thought, well, there's a lot of problems with religion. Was religion part of the lives of the photographers that worked for him?
Stryker was indicative of many intellectuals of the 1930s, which is that he started off in a family that was Christian. His father was an evangelical Christian who prayed and who made the family pray together in family prayers. But then when Stryker himself as an adult became involved with religion, he became very critical of its inability really to take seriously the changing character of American society. Protestant religious organizations didn't seem to really understand the fact that America was becoming much more diverse religiously. There are Catholics and there were Jews and African Americans moving up from the South and living in the cities. And many of the more traditional Protestant organizations just couldn't figure out how to deal with a diverse America. And this was actually the case with many of the photographers. Some of the photographers were Jewish. They had come to the United States with their families, oftentimes as small children. The families were not necessarily religiously Jewish. They weren't observant Jews, but they were culturally Jews. Many of them spoke Yiddish together. They were connected with organizations that supported Yiddish culture. And so many of these men were aware of a different kind of religion on the landscape. So the world that they grew up in was not the Protestant world that Stryker saw, but they grew up in a Jewish world. And so they were marginal to the mainstream American society, and oftentimes people who are on the margins can see things in the general culture that are missed by those of us who are just sort of living it. So people from the outside can see the inside a little bit better and sharper. So most of the photographers were raised in religious families, had connections with religion, but were not religious themselves, were not practicing at that time. And they were mostly young men and young women in their 20s. You know, they were seeing the world. You know, they were not thinking about, oh, establishing families and how do we pass on our morality and so on. They were very lucky because they had money and a car in a time when most people didn't, and they got to wander around the country and explore, and that was a very, very exciting for them.
Yeah, how were they paid? What were the benefits of the job?
Well, they had a stipend for their gas, and they had small salaries, and they were paid. They received film, and sometimes they were actually given cameras. And then they wandered around the country and followed, you know, and Stryker sent them off to Hidrinyan. And then they would take pictures. They would develop the film, and they would send the film back to Washington where it was printed up into images, or they were sent contact prints, and they were able to pick out prints that they wanted to have printed up.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine is Colleen McDaniel. She is a professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah. She is the author most recently of Picturing Faith, Photography, and the Great Depression. Listeners, my name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. One of the surprises here for me, Professor McDaniel, is the Jewish farmers in the East.
Right. One of the exciting things about the file is that you oftentimes see things that you don't expect. And, of course, historians are always asking the question, well, is it representative? You know, does everyone do this particular act? Or how typical is this? And what's wonderful sometimes is when you find things which are not particularly typical, and they can be quite interesting in themselves. We tend to think, and of course are correct in thinking, that most Jews lived in the large urban environments. They lived in cities on the coasts, and that they didn't farm. But as it turns out, that there were special programs which had been designed around the turn of the century to encourage Jews to leave the cities and to purchase land and to become farmers. And there was a small community in Connecticut where these people pretty much were in the majority. And so when one of the photographers went up to photograph the problems with part-time farmers, people who both worked in factories and farmed, he found himself in this village where there were all of these Jews. And the person who did the photographs, Jack Delino, he was raised in a Jewish family, although not a practicing Jewish family. And here were all these Orthodox Jews who were farmers and yet were quite involved in their in Jewish ritual life, as well as providing schools for their children and so on. And so the photographs that he took are quite interesting and give us a little glimpse into the alternative or different ways that American Jews experienced life. And once you start with the photographs, then you find out, well, there are other farming communities of Jews in New Jersey, and even here in Utah, there was a small farming community that was set up by Jews who had come from the East Coast. So it's an interesting glimpse into an alternative that oftentimes we forget.
Yeah. Were there other things that you didn't expect that you were surprised by?
I had, just thinking a bit about Gordon Parks, who, as you know, just recently died. He did a beautiful set of photographs when he was working for the Farm Security Administration of a an African-American woman who cleaned offices in the building where the photographers developed their film. And he followed her into her home and then eventually to her church. And when I first looked at the photographs, I was all excited because I thought, oh, how interesting. This is an African-American Catholic. She must have come up from Maryland. There's a large African-American community of Catholics in Maryland. She must have come up from Maryland to D.C. How interesting that he found her. But as it turned out, she belonged to a spiritual church, and spiritual churches were very popular among African Americans in the 1930s and 40s, and they were a combination of Pentecostal orientation towards the Spirit, and also used the Catholic. They had Catholic saints and were involved. They used a lot of statues and rituals that came out of Catholicism. So they were an interesting amalgamation of Protestantism and Catholicism. Hmm. And she was quite active. Her name was Ella Watson. She was quite active in her church. And the photographs are very exciting and quite interesting. And again, give us a glimpse into a world which we wouldn't really know of without these beautiful photographs.
What are the challenges for a historian interpreting photographs from decades earlier?
Well, it's very difficult, and one of the things that I discovered as I was working on the photographs was that historians had assumed certain things about religion that just, as it turned out, were not true. Some of the photographs and some of these problems began with the photographers themselves. In the early 40s, a set of photographers went to Chicago and took photographs of an African-American church. And for many years, both historians and photographers called this a Baptist church. And I think it's because they just assumed that most African-Americans were Baptists, which, of course, is true. Many African-Americans are Baptists. But this particular church was not a Baptist church. It was a Church of God in Christ church. And so I think it's important that historians really do the background work on what they're looking at, and always, especially with religion, to be aware that there are significant denominational differences, and that it's important to know what people are actually doing in the film, in the photograph. And sometimes you have to do the footwork and find out that you can't always read the photograph in a straightforward way. Sometimes you have to do a lot of work in order to understand. Photographs don't just speak. Sometimes you hear different things and they're not quite right.
Did the photographers of the Farm Security Administration Photographic Project include written documentation with their photographs?
Yes, they did. They captioned the photographs, but depending on who did it, the captions could either be wonderful or they could be very short. Walker Evans, who was not particularly interested in the social reform that many of the other photographers were interested in, his captions are very brief. Sometimes he didn't caption them at all. He didn't describe them at all. On the other hand, someone like Dorothea Lange wrote wonderful captions and really described what she was seeing. The other kind of written sources that I worked with in the Library of Congress, we have the letters that Stryker wrote to the photographers, and then the photographers wrote back to Stryker. And those letters also vary in their descriptive, the level of description. Some of the photographers were very chatty and sort of explained what they were seeing and where they were going and what they were doing and what people were saying to them. And others just wrote back, "We want more film, you know, send more film, send more film." So that was not very helpful for the historian. But that's, of course, you know, the difference of people. Some people are very thoughtful and reflect on what they experience, and other people, especially photographers who are very visually oriented, you know, they take the pictures. That's the way they communicate. And so as a historian, it's difficult. One of the things I did in writing Picturing Faith was I went to the communities, I traveled to the various places where the photographers photographed, and went and talked with people who were from the communities. And it was interesting to me to find out how resilient many of these communities are, and they still exist, and people remember, you know, the 30s and the 40s and the seniors and the documents that their communities, faith communities, still have in their archives. And so it was great to see what they look like now and how the photographers taking pictures of them, you know, what did they emphasize when they, for instance, if they were taking a picture of the church, did they make it look big or did they make it look small? You know, what did they forget these kinds of organizations and only take pictures of those organizations? And so that was a quite interesting thing to do, and that was part of what I did when I wrote Picturing Faith.
Yeah. Did the photographers ever meet resistance from folks?
They did at times. Usually it was because people didn't quite understand what they were doing, and they were a little bit shy about foreigners, you know, people coming down from the north to the south. You have to keep in mind that the FSA photographers were taking pictures in a time before television, before news magazines. You know, imagine a world where people just didn't have images of poverty. Now we're inundated in some ways, either in television or in print media, with images of people who are poor or starving, and some of us are just kind of overwhelmed by these images. But when the FSA photographers were traveling, that's not photography. Was, gee, you saved your money and you had a picture taken of you know, Uncle Tom by the traveling itinerant photographer, and it was a wonderful thing to have a picture. So many people were that you would think would not let these photographers into their homes, let them into their homes. And also, again, if we look back at the 30s, this was also a period when people were having severe dislocations and severe poverty because of the Depression, and they were excited about the possibility that the government might help them out, so that there was a very positive attitude about the federal government, again, unlike what we might have now. So what you would have would be, surprisingly, people were much more open to being photographed than they would be now. And those people who were shy or reluctant, it usually had to do with just they didn't quite know how to respond to photographers. There was a situation when Dorothea Lange photographed a church in the South, and everybody was kind of scurrying around trying to figure out who could give her permission to photograph inside the church. And they finally decided that they would not give her the permission. And I argue that Dorothea Lange, who liked to take photographs outside and use natural light, she probably didn't really want to go in the church anyway. And so she took beautiful photographs of the women of the church sitting on the steps of their church. And she captured a sense of that community without going inside the church itself.
Yeah. I mentioned in my introduction Lange's photograph, Migrant Mother. I think people will be very familiar with that image. But also what you include at the very outset of the book is another one of her photographs called Revival Mother. Describe that photograph to us.
That's a photograph that was also taken in California, not very far from where Migrant Mother was taken, and about the same period of time. And it's a photograph of a woman who is a Pentecostal preacher, and she has her arms raised up. She's in a garage surrounded by some other women and children, and it's a Sunday morning service. It's a revival meeting, and she is basically being filled with the Holy Spirit. She's having a relationship with God, which is very emotional and very strong. And when you look at the photograph, you don't feel the sense of insecurity or fear of the future or even poverty, even though this woman would have probably been just as poor and just as dislocated as Migrant Mother. But her relationship with her God and her expression doesn't make us feel pity for her. And I argue in the book that Migrant Mother was used by Stryker and has become a classic because it very much summarizes our stereotype about the Depression. I mean, this notion that people didn't know where they were going and that there were women and children were starving to death and so on. But what this photograph does is shows the other part of the Depression, which is that many people were involved in organizations and involved in religion that gave them strength and courage to face the difficulties that they had to face during this time, and that religion was one of the institutions which they carried with them from Arkansas or Kansas or the great Dust Bowl areas into places like California, and that survived. And even now, one of the reasons that parts of California are filled with people who are extremely religious and who still have country music and who have a certain style of worship is because their great-great-grandparents came from places in the what in those days was called the Southwest. Now we would probably call it the South.
Mm. One of the things that's striking, you mentioned Revival Mother being photographed in a garage, is that people didn't necessarily need a church, a building. It could be under a tree. It could be on the banks of a river. It could be within one's home where one might have, I'm thinking of the photographs of Russell Lee, where there are shrines to Christ and to saints.
The wonderful thing about religion is that people express their religious beliefs and involve themselves in religious practices that connect with their own sense of creativity, artistry, and innovation. So we tend to think of religion from the top down. We tend to think of a church or a synagogue having a set of rules that everybody has to follow. But when you actually look at the way people experience religion, it's very individual and it's very creative, and they carry religion and do religious activities in ways that sometimes go against the general authorities, but which very much speak to the needs that they have at a particular time. And the people who were displaced because of the Dust Bowl, they brought their religious ideas with them to California, and they were very different from the native Californians, the Protestants who had settled in California, who had established Protestant churches. We're not very excited about these poor people who didn't have very nice clothes and who worshipped in very emotional ways who had come to California. And so they made those people feel very much like outsiders. And so the migrants then established little communities themselves, informal communities of hymn singing and Bible reading and Sunday schools for their children, and then eventually began to establish more permanent structures, built their own churches, brought preachers in from the South that worshipped in ways that were comfortable for them. But it worked both ways. They had their own religious ideas, which they created and developed, but they also were excluded from the churches that were already in existence in places like California.
What do these photographs tell us about the religious practices of men, women, and children? You know, here we have Revival Mother. She's leading the service.
Well, it provides a lot of interesting ideas. One of the things that the Depression, one of the images that was that the photographers felt that they had to do was that they had to show that poverty was not the result of individuals' actions. And so Migrant Mother is a good example of that. She actually had more children than Dorothea Lange photographed, and she also was married. But to show a healthy white male who wasn't working, made people who looked at it ask a lot of questions, like, why isn't he working, and is he lazy, and maybe he drinks too much, and maybe it's really his fault, as opposed to a larger economic problem in the whole country. And so the photographers oftentimes would photograph women and children just to help us keep in mind that, oh, well, it's these innocent women and children who really shouldn't be working anyway, and look how you know, what a bad situation that they're in. And so you especially with religion, you oftentimes will have women and children in pictures and not the men, even though the men are quite active in religious activities. And that's particularly the case in some of the photographs of the Mexican shrines in Texas and Arizona. And in that case, the women really do maintain those shrines. That's part of their religious activities in the home. They're the experts in the home. And so there are beautiful photographs of women and children sitting next to the shrines that they've put together.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, things start to think about this, the photographs of men that I'm thinking about now from the book Picturing Faith, they look like they are working men. I'm thinking of, I'm looking right now at a photograph made by Arthur Rothstein, a man lighting a lamp in front of religious prints in his home. And he looks like he's, you know, I don't know. Here, I'm making up a story, aren't I?
Well, I think, again, it's we tend to, again, associate religion with women and children. And that, again, is what the photographs work against as well, many men were also quite involved in religious activities. And because of the poverty of the Great Depression, oftentimes they didn't feel comfortable going to church. They didn't have the proper clothes. They had holes in their shoes. And so they felt embarrassed being in the public space of the church. And so men and women would do many religious activities at home and continue their belief in God and their expressions of devotion and their relationship with the saints and with the Virgin Mary for Catholics. And so these men that we might not see in the public space of the church would continue these private devotions at home. And again, that works against many of our stereotypes that, gee, men don't have anything to do with the home. They're only out there in the busy work world. But that's not necessarily the case, and the photographs help us see that.
Mm. Were any photographs made of mosques or people who practice Islam?
There were not that many Muslims in the United States at that point. In the 1930s and early 40s, you have the rise in places like Chicago of African Americans who are being drawn to various forms of Islam that eventually would develop into the Nation of Islam. And so you didn't have these kinds of organizations. They were still in their kind of beginning state. And for the most part, the photographs were taken in rural America. And so while you might have some Muslims or certainly Buddhists and in places where there were larger larger urban centers out in the southern countryside or in the Midwest, people were not, it was not quite so diverse. But also I argue that Stryker himself didn't really understand the diversity that did exist even in the 1930s. And so he still, like many Americans, and even like many Americans now, just sort of think of the United States as being made up of Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, when in effect there were many other different religious communities. But he just didn't even know this was, you know, that this was there, so to ask the photographers, you know, to take pictures. And he did, you know, he initially, the point, of course, was to take pictures of rural America, right? They're being funded by the Farm Security Administration. But Stryker himself, he had other ideas, and he wanted to make a visual portrait of the whole country. And he oftentimes would send photographers to places where they, you know, where there was nothing rural around, and because he wanted to get pictures of small town America, life in small towns, and life in cities as well.
What about we got to wrap up here really quickly? But what about Native Americans? Was that just off the radar too? Or
Native Americans were very controversial during the 1930s as well, because a part of the New Deal was an effort to try to recognize their standing in the country and to fix all of the horrible things which Americans had done, especially the government had done to Native American people. And so the government, probably for the first time in its history, was a little more sensitive than normal. And so there was a reluctance to send photographers to photograph Native Americans. And also Native Americans were not all that, you know, obviously they had been exploited visually, and they were not so enthused about this. So one of the sets of photographs that I talk about in Picturing Faith was of a Catholic priest in New Mexico, and they actually took his picture because Native Americans would not let the photographers take pictures of their tribal communities. That's how we got these wonderful photographs of Catholics in New Mexico.
Hmm. Have you thought about doing an exhibition, or maybe you have already done an exhibition of these photographs?
Yes, I have a traveling exhibition of the photographs. There are 45 of these photographs. They're framed, and they have caption panels. And the photographs right now are at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And then in the 1st of April, they move to Haverford College, which is outside of Philadelphia. And they've been traveling around for about 4 years, and they go to museums and college campuses. And I love the exhibit because it basically is doing what Stryker intended the photographs to do, which is to teach Americans about America. And it's a wonderful exhibition, and if people are interested in hosting it, if they email me or call me at the University of Utah, we can talk about it being hosted. It comes in four big crates, and it's an exhibition also called Picturing Faith.
Very good. There we have to leave it. Colleen McDaniel, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Our guest this afternoon, Colleen McDaniel, is professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah. Her most recent book, Picturing Faith, Photography, and the Great Depression.